Okay, Sven Longshanks is here to tell us about his recent reading of the Gesta Danorum, or Deeds of the Danes, which was written by Saxo Grammaticus, a Danish historian who died in the early 13th century, I think about 1220 AD, if I'm not mistaken. Hello, Sven.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, thanks for having me on for this. I've really enjoyed reading this book. It was a Danish associate of mine told me about it, and he said I might find it interesting. And I looked and I found a copy of it. First off, I wanted to get the copy that was translated around about 1900. And then I saw that there was a more recent copy in the 1970s, and that was easier to get hold of. And I was a little bit worried at first. Hilda Ellis Davison, she's the one that added the commentary, and Peter Fisher did the translation. But it's actually very, very good. And the reviews of it, the mainstream reviews, they say, well, it's not the best literature. It doesn't use the best descriptions. You can't really feel much empathy with the characters. And I thought the language was used was fantastic. I thought it was very, very descriptive, very eloquent. The characters themselves, I felt a lot of empathy for, and there's so many morals within it. There's so much teaching within it. It'd be a really useful book, I would suggest, for young men to read, to understand the way that men should behave, properly behave, not the way that they're taught to behave by today. I mean, they're taught to be masculine, but at the same time, eloquence and intelligence and wit, that's really, really highly revered. And there's quite a few bits and pieces that I've taken from it to get some notes just so that I can go through it, because there are so many correspondences with Christian identity. Yeah, because
let me say something. This is a book that I've always wanted to read, and I never had the chance to. So maybe you will inspire me to finally read it. But this book was quoted, it was cited by several Christian identity writers. I know that E. Raymond Katz cited this book. I don't remember where, but that's how I found out about Saxo Grammaticus back in the late 90s. Reading Christian identity literature. He's not mentioned by Swift or Comparé, but he's mentioned by the more studious, historically studious Christian identity writers, maybe Balakaius, somebody like that. So I've known about Saxo for a long, long time. I just never read it, right? And it's a little late anyway.
Well, it's enjoyable to read. It's nine books, and the first four or five books are the best. And it really develops the characters. And then the later books, because they've got so many kings that he's trying to fit in there, it's a bit harder to read. It doesn't develop the characters so much because you've got whole events happening in the space of a few sentences, whereas the stories are much more fleshed out in the earlier ones. And, of course, in the earlier ones, it's mixed in with legend. The first book, it begins, it says the ancestor of the Danes was Dan, who the French also called the Danoi or the Danans. So it says that's where they came from, and their ancestor was Dan. And then it immediately goes into talking about giants, and the giants are trying to breed with women, and they create hellspawn, they create bastards. And the Danes they want to prevent this from happening. They want to prevent these giants from breeding with women. And of course, there's a parallel there with Genesis 6, with the sons of God that came down to the daughters of men and created giants. And you've also got instances with things like dragons and magicians or sort of warlock types. And so, of course, today they've said, well, this is all just fantasy. But in actual fact, it was probably used as in a mnemonic way, in order for them to be able to remember these stories. They would add these other bits in there that were more of an analogy than anything else. And I think over time, we just hear about the dragons and the giants and what have you. And we think, oh, they're just mystical beings, because it tells you that, these giants, they actually look like everybody else. Some of the heroes in it, they disguise themselves as giants. So it's not actually talking about somebody that's a huge height. It was obviously some type of being that had a different power to everybody else, and they interbreed with the women, and of course they're against that because there's a really, really strong thread that goes right the way through it, which is about how important your bloodline is. More important than anything else is your bloodline. That's more important than deeds. There's one instance where there's a really courageous person, and it tells you all these courageous deeds that he's done, and then he tries to win the hand in marriage of somebody who's a noble. And today, the end of the story would be that he wins the hand of the woman because he's such a courageous person. But Saxo Grammaticus, no, that's totally wrong. It doesn't matter what his deeds are. He cannot mingle his blood with this noble woman because she's of different bloodline. And it doesn't matter what your deeds are. More important than that is your heritage and where you come from, which again is a Christian identity message. It's all about your bloodline. If you're a non-white, it doesn't matter what you do. You're not going to get eternal life. And it's that same morality that runs right the way through this book, which I found, I wasn't expecting to find that. And of course, it tells us that our ancestors years ago, they placed so much importance upon this idea that we are all equal, and a woman can do this just as good as a man. We're just like economic units. That's totally alien to the way that we thought. They had a caste system that was really, really rigid, and it was seen as so wrong if anybody married down. There's one instance where a king actually sleeps with non-royalty, and I've got a quote here, and this is describing the bastard as he grows up, and it says, "When the boy had grown a little, even at a tender age, his mind took on qualities of mature discernment. His affections were directed towards his mother, because she had slept with a superior partner, whereas he refused to revere a father who had lowered himself to a union that fell short of nobility." And that's the same thing I think that we see with the non-whites. They always associate themselves with the black part of themselves, never with the white part of themselves, because it's the black part of themselves has married upwards, hasn't it? And the white part has degraded itself, and instead of passing on the white bloodline, it's destroyed that white bloodline. So there's resentment there in amongst these blacks. So even though it's not talking about the different races, it's talking about within the race and within the nation, but it's exactly the same principle. That principle had to have come from somewhere. Did you want to say something on that, Bill?
Well, yeah, I want to talk about the moral principles. It's to me, it's obvious that he is projecting moral principles that traditional Christians should understand were always a part of European thought, of the tribalism of and the chivalry of ancient Europe, and medieval Europe especially. But the earlier parts of what you spoke about also are important to me, because Saxo Grammaticus, he grew up during the 12th century, right? He was born in the middle of the 12th century, is relating to us these tales, these myths, whatever you want to call them, these accounts, because some of them are historical accounts, connecting the Danes to the ancient Danans, and the Danans are the people that had left Egypt and gone to Greece, right? They were the Hebrew tribe of Dan. They left Egypt. They went to Greece. They settled in the Peloponnesus. They were then conquered. That they defeated the Trojans. They were then conquered by the Dorians and subjected by them. But the Danans also were known to have traveled far and wide and settled in Sardinia and points in Western Europe that weren't even known at the time to Greeks or the later Romans. So the Danans were always known as great travelers, And we in Kush identity have always known that the Danes descended from the Danans. Well, Saxo Grammaticus is obviously an important element in that understanding. And his, it seems to me from what you said, that his relating of these stories with gods and giants and all of this shows that he in Denmark always had the same general culture and mythology that all of these Hebrews had, that all of these ancient Israelites had, and all of these connected cultures such as the Greeks.
It also shows you what was important to them, the teachings that got passed down to them. When you strip away the scriptures, and if you strip away everything that the tribes of Israel lost when they were deported from the land of Judah and the land of Israel, you strip all that and take all that away, and what did those tribes have left that they held on to? Well, that they held on to this importance of the blood, they held on to this importance of heritage, and they held on to these stories about these giants that were interbreeding with the women, which shows you that was what was most important to them. And from what I can make out, the history sort of begins about 300 years before Christ, something like that. And yet they've got this very high standard of civilization as well, which you can tell from the way that they behave. There's a lot of verbal jousting. There's a lot of poetry. When someone would come to the king, he would be tested of how eloquent he was, how knowledgeable he was. And that would help to determine who he was, because only these people, obviously they had this eugenics, and only the people that had interbred, kept breeding within their line, would keep passing on the high IQ and the skill sets to be able to do these sort of things. So a very high value was placed on eloquence, just as high a value was placed upon that as was placed upon sword play and courage in battle, which I guess ties in with the bards. But then there's a very surprising bit, because they have this high standard of civilization, which is shown by the way they behave to one another and the language that they use, and also by their ships. And yet the main pastime is piracy. The main pastime is stealing from other people. And those two things don't add up. And that's again why the mainstream say, well, you know, this can't be true because they were all pirates. They were just savages. But they weren't, because they had all this eloquence and they had all these skills as well. And this ties in to me. It's as if it's a people that had their civilization taken from them, which is what happened in Judah and in Israel with the Assyrian and the Babylonian deportations. They lost all their scriptures. They lost all their civilization, and they became barbarians. As we know, the Saxons became mercenaries, basically. And it seems these Danes became pirates. And yet at the same time, they retained this knowledge that they had and these skill sets that they had and the technology that they had. So with the Christian identity theory, that all adds up, and it's truthful. With the mainstream researchers' way of looking at it, they will say, well, it can't add up. They can't have been pirates and at the same time had a same level of technology. So you see, it doesn't add up for them, but it adds up for me. When I'm reading about this, there's a guy in there called Eric the Eloquent, and the tales of Eric the Eloquent are fantastic. The way he deals with people, with this verbal jousting, and yet at the same time, he's a really fierce warrior. And there's instances where they will say, well, we won't fight, and we'll take a vow, and we won't fight unless we're actually fighting 10 men at one time. Really sort of crazy things like that they do, and yet they're also very, very clever as well. And now we get this image of the muscle man as being a bit of a meathead, and the intelligent people as being weaklings wearing spectacles or whatever. But back at this time, where you had a eugenic system, you had the highly intelligent were also the great warriors. And these were the people that were the kings and the nobles, and you couldn't just take anybody and put him on the throne, like they'll try and say today, oh, it was just an accident of kingship, you could put anybody there. You couldn't do that. They had to be descended.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. You're right about kingship, and all throughout medieval European civilization, princes were highly educated and actually trained to be rulers. And they all had notable tutors as the principality or kingdom could afford, that they were granted the best tutors available, the monks and other learned men who were famous for their learning would be the ideal tutor for a prince, right? And that's how it always worked. Ancient Greek kings were trained, ancient Greek rulers were trained by the famous philosophers that they had as tutors. Well, anyway, that's a digression. You had mentioned something, and now that I think the digression sort of distracted me from my question. So I'm sorry. I'll remember it as we continue.
Well, I was talking about the high standard of civilization, and yet they were engaging in piracy as well. And once a king has got the country together and he's made advances in the laws to protect the chastity of women or whatever, then they go off and engage in piracy again, which is the national pastime because that's all they do. So maybe that might help you.
Right. And here's the parallel I was going to make. If you study ancient Mesopotamia and the ancient Levant in the literature of the other nations, the Hebrews were slaves, not only the Israelites who were in Egypt, but the Hebrews, the Abiru of northern Mesopotamia and northern Syria were known as slaves or as robbers. And if you really examine the ancient history in the biblical record, you'll see that the Hebrews and the descendants of Arphaxad had no homeland. All of the other Genesis 10 nations, which Moses recorded, had a known specific homeland. So something happened early in history that's beyond our ability to understand because we don't have records, that these Hebrew people lost their original homeland. Abraham and the Hebrews are not of the tribe of Aram, yet they were dwelling in Padan Aram, which is the plain of Aram. And they're a related people, but where's the Hebrew homeland? There is none. So they became either slaves or brigands, robbers. And that's how they're known in the inscriptions. So this has happened before. We have these Scythian tribes that are dispossessed of their original land in the Assyrian captivities. And they go off to the north and even though that they are educated and cultured and have a sense of the rule of law, and they have all of that instilled in them, they become wanderers and brigands or robbers or pirates or however you want to put it. And they spend 1,000 years in that condition, 1,500 years in that condition until Christianity civilizes them once again.
There's also the question of where this kingship actually came from. If it came from this bloodline that was passed down, and you couldn't just put anybody on the throne, there's also the question of where did that begin? And they say that it began with Dan, but it obviously began with somebody that was extra special, and it couldn't have just been because of his deeds or his courage, because it tells you that later on. Deeds and courage mean nothing compared to the bloodline. Everything is about the bloodline. And it's interesting you brought up the Scythians there and Scythia, because it refers to the Scythians and Scythia, and from the context of it is it's talking about the Germanic tribes, and it's talking about the Germanic tribes, and there's one of these tribes of Saxons that's called the Scythians, and yet the map that it has with the book, it shows you Scythia as sort of being somewhere off towards Persia, which is obviously that's today's mainstream way of looking at it. But Nennius, when he was writing in the 9th century, he said that the Saxons that came over to Britain, they came over from Scythia. And he wasn't saying right. That these Saxons came from Persia. At this time, part of Germany and part of these Saxons, they were still called Scythians. You know, that's why it's in there, I think.
Well, that's... So basically, Saxo Grammaticus is not only supporting, but expounding on the Christian identity narrative in the migrations of these disenfranchised people, right? Who would be the Israelites. Not every Scythian migrant into Europe was an Israelite. The Scythians had themselves, and this is actually a prophecy in Isaiah that the children of Israel would take captive the people that took them captive. And it's recorded in Diodorus Siculus that the Israelites, when they migrated, when these Cymri or these Sakae migrated into Europe, that they brought with them slaves of the Assyrians and the Medes and the Persians. And when they were first taken into captivity, they were settled in the cities of the Medes and the Persians. They were spread out all the way to Sogdiana and Bactria from the Black Sea. I mean, that's a wide, probably 1,000-mile wide frontier that the Assyrians had resettled these tribes on, and then these tribes end up leaving that area and migrating up into Asia and Europe. So it's not far-fetched to imagine that Scythians came from Persia, because that is where they came from. They weren't necessarily all Persians, though. They certainly weren't all Persians. They were Saka. If they were Persians, they would have had another name.
Yeah, and when the Danes are fighting with them, it's obviously a Scythia that's in Germany, because that's where Nennius said that the Saxons came from was Scythia. He didn't mention Germany, but that was actually where they had come from. So at the time, Germany was being called Scythia, and the people there were being called Scythians. That's what it seems to show to me. There's another part of it. Obviously, they use the runes. And messages is passed by carving a rune into tree bark, and then that's passed as a message to the British king or to these other kings. And the runes themselves are very close to the ancient Hebrew alphabet, the Phoenician alphabet. If you look at the two together, they're extremely similar and close to the Vinca culture. So that's another part of it. And I mean, these are just some of the thoughts that have come to mind. I haven't done a proper study of it. They're just the thoughts that come to mind at the end of it. And after I finished reading this book, I watched a video by Survive the Jive, and he's a British pagan, and he does a lot of genetic studies, DNA studies. And every time I watch his DNA studies, they are providing proof for Christian identity theory. It's quite bizarre. Every time I watch them, it does. And this particular one that I saw, he was talking about Viking DNA. And this was Viking DNA before they'd actually come to Britain. And yet 25% of this Viking DNA before they came to Britain, he said, was British DNA. Which to me bore out the Welsh histories, which say that the Cimmerians or Brutus or the two together, one of the two, went to Crimea, also went to Denmark, also went to Normandy, and also went to Wales. Which again fits in with Christian identity, with the Cimmerians when they made their way into Europe. Some of them ended up in Denmark, some of them ended up in Britain, some of them ended up in the Crimea. But that's what this DNA is, that is in these Vikings, these Viking bodies that they found. So there's proof for that as well. And the final thing that it made me think about in this book was, why is it never used by pagans? Why do we never hear pagans talking about this? Because the majority of the book is talking about the Danes, but before they were Christians, and yet I've never heard them talk about it before. All I've ever heard them do is attack Christianity, and this is exactly the sort of thing that, if somebody believed in all this stuff, this is exactly the sort of thing you would think they would be quoting and looking at and expanding upon, and yet they're not. That just shows you that their whole... The whole thing about pagans is just to attack Christians. It's not to actually look at their history, unfortunately.
Well, right. Otherwise, they'd listen to Jordanes and Saxo and Nennius and other early writers, and they don't. They only quote Snorri, the Eddas. That's, and they don't even know the Eddas. most of the pagans I've talked to don't even know the Eddas. I know, I haven't even read all the Eddas, but I know more about the Eddas than most of the pagans I've spoken to. They don't know their own literature. That they only know the stories that they hear repeated in other sources and in, recent articles. You wonder why anybody would be discouraged from reading Saxo Grammaticus. That's why. That's why you get your negative reviews in these literary clubs or literary columns today. That's why. They don't want us reading this. I mean, it's the Marxist plan to disconnect people from their history, where if they read Saxo Grammaticus, they would embrace history. And in fact, Shakespeare's Hamlet is even based on a story from Saxo Grammaticus, right?
Yeah. I mean, and also, I mean, the commentary, the notes, it tells you that there are links with the sagas and where these stories also appear, and they're slightly different. And I'd like to have a read of those as well. I mean, it really a fascinating book. I can't recommend it enough, really. I would say the first four or five books I'd give 10 out of 10. And then the later books I'd give 9 out of 10. But I'm very glad I bought it. I'm very glad it was recommended to me. And, you know, I would recommend it to young men in particular to read, to find out about our history and to get a good moral grounding in the way that men should behave, basically. And all these Christian identity bits as well.
Does Saxo Grammaticus mention any of the material that's in the Eddas or references to any of the characters of the Eddas, like the Heimskringla, the Ynglinga saga, anything like that?
Yeah, I think he mentions the names of people that are similar and similar stories. So it was bardic literature, really. It was spoken word that was memorized, and that was the stories of all the people that lived in that area of Scandinavia. So Saxo Grammaticus version might be slightly different to the version that's in the sagas. But yes, they talk about the same people. So they must have existed.
Well, right. I noticed that ages ago with the differences between the sagas recorded in Snorri's Eddas and the same characters that are mentioned in the Nibelungenlied. Now, the Nibelungenlied is a product of probably, in the form we know it, it's probably from the 13th century. But the story is set in the 5th century. I believe maybe 6th, but I think it's 5th. Well, the same characters are mentioned, but they have different roles or different attributes. It's like the myths were confounded over time in different areas. So but they're the same stories. So just because Saxo Grammaticus mentions a character from the Eddas doesn't necessarily mean that he agrees with the narrative as it appears in the sagas, in the Eddas.
Yeah, and it's the morals that are important about it. You know, I mean,
right.
Witnesses see things in a different way, and stories get told in a different way, and the important part of it is the sort of moral that's behind it, really.
Absolutely.
That's the central part of the book, really, is you know, the importance of the blood. I can't stress that enough. And I don't think, you know, Saxo Grammaticus himself, he can't stress that enough. That's the theme that runs right the way through it, is that the bloodline is more important than anything else. And you have to guard it. And of course, we're not today. It's a fascinating book. I'm going to have a look at some of these sagas, I think, and, see what they're like as well.
Well, the morality of race is being destroyed by the same people who don't want you to read Saxo Grammaticus. I mean, there were many earlier writers who spoke about the Germans and the various tribes of Germans in particular. Did Saxo mention or draw on Tacitus in his Germania or Bede, who wrote about the Germans and Christian ministries to the Germans in 500 years before him, or even Jordanes?
Yeah, he mentions Bede. He mentions the different Saxon tribes. He talks about Charlemagne. He talks about the Christian mission to the Saxons and to the Danes. But it's kind of sort of rushed through when compared to the earlier stuff, because it's recent history and he's trying to cram a lot in there, I think. So the beginning of the book is more literary, and or the beginning books are more literary, and the ones at the end are more like records of what happened. But yeah, he does mention Bede, and he mentions all the different Germanic tribes and the battles that the Danes had against them, and the Russians, the battles that they had against the Russians. And there's one point when they go into Siberia, that's called Biarmia land, and that's quite akin to traveling into the underworld. There's a lot of supernatural goings on that happen when they go into Siberia. And of course they had a lot of shamans in Siberia, and a totally different way of doing things. And he talks about Odin is in there, and Odin is a king, and Odin is also a god. And he says that they were worshipping Odin by mistake, and he was just a human, basically. And he talks about Byzantine and the Byzantine emperors, and when the Danes go to the city of Constantinople, and it's all placed in with the history that we know of, AD, basically, and then tied in with these legendary mystical accounts as well. So for somebody that was looking for more information on these different Saxon tribes, yeah, it's a great book for that, because it lists all of them and the individual battles that they had. And the instances with the Russians are interesting as well, the Ruteni. And another thing that it shows is that all these different tribes, they were all one race, but just these different tribes. And they're all interacting with one another, fighting amongst one another, you know, taking slaves and selling them and all the rest of it. And there's a lot to do with the Slavs in there as well. Talks about the Slavs a lot. It's quite a European book, really, thinking about it in that way, with all the different European nations are in there and the interactions that they had with one another.
Well, the mention of the earlier literature shows that Saxo Grammaticus was indeed learned. He was learned. That word Grammaticus is an epithet which means learned. So he was a well-read, educated man in the 12th century in Denmark.
Definitely. And I think it's really well written. I mean, they said that the Latin that he used was clumsy, but you know, it's one of the most well written books I think I've ever read. And that's the I don't know if that's from the translation or just the prose that he was using, the language that he uses. It gives you a sense of nostalgia reading it, you know, what we've lost.
Well, I would not, accept a criticism of Latin writing except from somebody who could write in Latin. Okay.
Yeah.
If a reviewer or a critic cannot write in Latin, then he's only repeating somebody else's conjecture or somebody else's vitriol or whatever. You have no business saying the Latin is clumsy unless you can write in Latin. That's my opinion. So
I think
a lot of these people that they merely repeat somebody else who just disdained a writer for some reason. And like, oh, okay, Hitler's German was said to be, he's a raging lunatic and all. And I've read Mein Kampf in several English translations, and he's not a raging lunatic at all. And I have never seen a native German writer say that Hitler couldn't write in German. So,
yeah, he's very insightful.
It's just a modern example.
This is written in Danish, but there is somebody that's gone through it all and said, look, all this happened, and he's proved it all. Apparently it's very hard to read, and it's only in Danish, unfortunately. There's no English translation. It would be good to find out more about that, because the Danes themselves have looked at it and said, oh no, this is just fairy tales for children or whatever. And they don't read it, which is such a great shame. But apparently there was one guy that went through it all to prove it, basically. And he did, but it's only written in Danish, and it's hard to get hold of. So it'd be interesting.
Well, that
to find
goes
out more
back
about
to that Marxist thought of separating us from our history.
Yeah, well, that's the way to get back to our history.
It's a plot as old as time.
Yeah.
Okay, Sven, thank you. That was wonderful. And it's great to hear that Saxo Grammaticus would be an inspiring read for probably all of our listeners and in more ways than one because of the moral lessons that underlie it.
Yeah, definitely. One final thing. I mean, I hate to admit this, but it is actually a better read than The Brute, The Chronicle of England, which is the English Chronicle, which goes back further, but there's no way that it's written as well. And that's what Geoffrey of Monmouth based his History of the Kings of England on. And the History of the Danes is probably, it's up there with the History of the Kings of England. It's a better book than the Brute, The Chronicle of England. And I think people get a lot more out of reading this History of the Danes than they would The Chronicle. The Chronicle's just good for reference, really. But this is, you know, something worth reading. So yeah, thank you for allowing me on to talk about it, Bill. Much appreciated.
Right. I never read The Brute Chronicle, but I believe that Sharon Turner based a lot of his history, the Anglo-Saxons, on it, and I have read that. Okay, thank you, Sven, and I appreciate you being here. I don't really know when we're going to use this, but we'll use it soon. It'll air at Christogenia soon.
Thank you, Bill. God bless.
Thank you. Yahweh bless. Praise Christ.